He said later on you got another job became available in Madison. Mm-hmm. And you did take that,
mm-hmm.
did you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So your relief at not having to work gave way to the need to have some more money. Is that what happened, or?
I'm sure it was probably money.
Well,
and then it would be interesting too, you know.
Hmm.
After all, curiosity kind of.
How old was the baby then?
Tiny.
So how did you manage it?
Well, very lucky. Are you recording now?
Yes.
Oh, okay. First, I had to decide if I wanted to take the job. Well, I interviewed before it and decided I would do it, that it would be enough money. Now, I can't remember what the money was, so that it would help supplement the rather low income. And I had to find out whether my aunt in Milwaukee, whose husband was out of work, whether, and he had gone west by this time, so that she was free.
Mm-hmm.
In Milwaukee, she was doing housework there to earn money, and she was willing to come on and stay in our house. I never could have done it if she hadn't been willing
to
do that.
So
thinking back, she was just
worry about
willing to do it, and she
something.
Did. And what would you like?
I just need a pencil or something to. I don't know, I must have one.
Came on and I split my pay with her. That was the financial arrangement. But before she could come, we did have to hire another girl. I had to go to the employment agency because she could come at a certain date, but not before, and I had to start my job. So there were these little details to work out.
Was it a full-time job?
Yeah, it was a full-time job. And it was adding to their office for us, must have been 10, 15 people, because the Bangs Disease Project involved the whole state and veterinarians all over the state who obviously did need the money. I'm sure this was, many people called this a boondoggling, New Deal boondoggling project, and they were making fun of using Bangs disease, which was brucellosis in cattle. Many people made fun of this because they said that this was not important. And whenever I see items now about brucellosis in cattle and coping with it and so on, and it has been cut down a great deal in the state, but when I see these items, I think about those days when the project was being made fun of.
Mm.
Because actually, I guess it was a serious project and was doing some good.
Hmm.
But the veterinarians were hired to test the cattle. Farmers very often had more cattle than they could feed in those days, and they were not making money.
Mm-hmm.
The Depression days were really grim. They were grimmer than I realized at the time. They seemed grimmer looking back on them even than they did then. Because while we were not rich by any means, we always had enough to eat, and we were living a good full life, and it didn't occur to me, at least, to think that this was, that we were benighted in any way. We were just coping. Well, what I did there was to check the veterinarians' expense accounts as they came in.
That was your job.
And I learned to use the Monroe calculator, very routine, ordinary typist job. And I did this for about a year, and at the end of that time, Llewellyn had a chance to take a job in Washington with the Department of Agriculture, but not as a farmer. Lord knows he never had anything to do with agriculture as the practical end of it. But he had been teaching constitutional law, had considerable work in constitutional law, and so he was with the Land Use Planning Division of the Department of Agriculture, and what they did was to work on legislation which was being set up all over the country, and then work with state legislatures. Legislation dealing with farm zoning and firm problems.
Was it his familiarity with people like Garrison here and or no. somebody else who
No,
lived
but
there
with John
there?
Gross, oh. I would say.
Uh-huh. So you gave up your job to go?
Yes, it wasn't too hard.
No, I don't suppose so.
It was a great bunch of people to work with. Some of them are still around. I run into them around town. And, person who was the head of the office for us there under Dr. Healy was Catherine Minch. And she was a very interesting person, part of an old-time Madison family.
Yeah,
she continued to work. She was a career civil servant. And there were a number. She had a sister.
Oh, this
in
is
town.
In your office here?
Uh-huh, here.
I see.
That
yes.
was here. And she just died last year or a year before. I think she was in her 90s. But at any rate, yes, I gave up my job. First, we had to rent the house
yeah.
to a family, which we did. And a friend in Washington found a house for us there, Northeast Washington. It was furnished. Can't remember how much we paid. I think it was about $85 a month rent for a furnished house in Washington. So, let's see. We went on there. And
just before, I'd like to ask you, because this must have been sort of a break point. Had you been at all active in the League during up until then?
Up until then.
I mean, in the League of Women Voters?
Not except as being a member.
You did go to the meetings.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. So,
and was
sure.
Were you interested in politics at that time?
I was interested in the League meetings. Because actually that field was new. I suppose if I hadn't got into it by the back door, I never would really have become interested in politics or government.
You mean you're speaking of the League as the back door? Or
no, I'm speaking of being married to a political
oh, okay.
scientist
that
as
the other possibility.
Actually, I guess it was the front door.
Yeah.
But just kind of came at it sideways, I suppose. And I think that the problems of the Depression were just so all-consuming that you just automatically got interested in government because how things were being handled and at every level of government became very important economically, I think.
Was Julia Bacolt in the League? Or
I don't know. I didn't know her. I don't know at what I don't believe I knew her personally at that time.
Did you get to meet Governor La Follette? Did you have anything to do with the political, did Llewellyn with political affairs?
He never has been what I would call a practical politician.
Mm.
He's a political scientist.
Mm-hmm.
He knows a lot about it and his judgment's awfully good, but he's never got into organizational nitty-gritty of politics at all.
Quite different.
But as far as getting to know the La Follettes, through John Gross, yes, we did get to know the La Follettes. We got to know both of them. And not in an intimate way, but this is out of context, but we did, see, what year would they have been in Germany? Eisen and Phil La Follette were in Germany shortly before he came back and set up the Independent Progressive Party. Here's where my dates.
Well, that doesn't
work.
Matter.
Dates
the dates are always available. Yeah.
At any rate, the Gosses had them both over to their house
mm-hmm.
one evening and had the faculty and wives of the department to hear their report of Germany, of their visit to Germany. And I think this is a difference. I don't think you'd find this now, but after, I don't remember whether this was a buffet supper or evening refreshments, but after refreshments we divided so that the women went into one room with Eisen La Follette and Jane Gosse, and the husband stayed back in the living room with Phil and John Goss, which I don't think would happen now. Do you?
No. It's surprising that
I don't know what the men listened to, frankly, exactly now. But I remember listening to Mrs. La Follette talk about particularly the work in Germany with young people. And I think that she, at least, was quite impressed with the Hitler program for the youth. And the youth, I believe she described it as youth camps. And the other night I saw James Luther Adams' movies of his visit to Germany about that same time, and he had pictures of a youth camp, his own movies, mm-hmm. technically not very good, but adequate. The youth marching back and forth with shovels, which were obviously in place of guns, which were they weren't allowed to have. And Adams' impression was that this was certainly military training. Well, you didn't get any of this from Eisenhower's description, so it may have been different youth camps that she went to. But she felt that dealing with unemployed youth was very important, which it was. And this, you see, was important to us because it was a period when we had the very same problem in this country, depression time. So that whether she was making, whether she was blind to things that were going on there that should have been obvious, I don't know. I can only go by the fact that she was taken with his program and with youth there.
Yeah.
And it was an interesting evening. And I thought about it later as things got hotter and hotter in Germany. But this was my main contact with La Follette.
I see.
Was meeting them that evening. And then seeing them a great many times, of course, in public, at public things. Let's see. What beyond that?
Well,
the German, if my mind continues on that track of being in Washington, one of the things about being in Washington that impressed me particularly after we got back home was how much closer it is to Europe, how really isolated we are back here. When things are happening in Europe and you're in Washington, you feel much more international than you do back here. It's just automatic somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, this was in the New Deal days. It wasn't later. We were back in Washington again in 1945 in the midst of the war, which was still a different period. But a similar situation, even then when we were in the war, we felt much closer because, for one thing, we had blackout drills when every house had to have its windows blacked out and you had air raid wardens.
The man
next door was an air raid warden. Now, whether they were doing that here, I don't know.
They were in New England.
I don't think they were here.
I don't know.
I don't think so. But at any rate, we were in Washington for a year and a half the first time. And then came back here to the little house on Lakeside.
Yeah. And did you go back to work again?
No, I went back to school.
And this time, seriously, to get
your degree. I took 9 credits one semester, I remember. And I remember I took Glenn Terwarth's physical geography.
Mm-hmm.
A great course. I had great teachers on the campus. And my husband's colleagues were great teachers.
What did you finally major in?
German.
You did?
Mm-hmm. Actually, my bent all the time was in languages and music, if I had ever got off on that track earlier. I think it would have been, probably. Mm-hmm. So.
But this was just for your, you weren't thinking of a career.
No,
you
were just, it was just what interested myself. You.
Yes. Well, nothing wrong with that in college.
No, but now things really are oriented to job training.
Well, not necessarily.
I mean, almost all of the women's programs are geared to achievement of,
well, it's a sad commentary on education, but I don't think that college was meant to be job training.
And then, of course, at that point, I did need to have help all the time because I had David in school. And I would try to see that somebody would be there. If I had something over the noon hour, I'd have to have somebody home to, when he came home from Franklin School for lunch. He'd have to have somebody there. So we were very lucky because I advertised in the paper and one person came out as a result of the ad, and she was the wife of a painter who was out of work, and she had never done work like this before in her life. Her name was Laura Vitense, and she worked for, I keep saying $5, but might have been $7. I mean, everything that we did then seemed to cost $5. It for a week, this was.
Oh, goodness.
She didn't work 8 hours a day, but she came 5 days a week. And it couldn't have been $5. It must have been more than that. But at any rate, she did come and work and was there the few hours during the day that I needed her. And she was simply a wonderful person. She loved animals, and we had a cat. And she would step over the cat in the kitchen if it was lying on the floor, the way she did with her own at home. Loved David, took very good care of him, and was just a great person to fit into our scheme of things at that time.
Did Llewellyn stayed on campus all day, I suppose? And did he, at night?
He didn't come home for lunch. He used to enjoy lunch times were good times to see people and have lunch with them. And he did not take his lunch.
He ate at the university club, did he? Or?
Ate all over the place, wherever. We were not members of the university club. I think we were briefly for a while. But we didn't use the club enough
Why not?
Just weren't in that groove, I think.
How would you describe that groove?
Well, of wanting to use it socially a great deal and entertain people at dinner and at the club. And
was it a matter of money or of interests?
Well, I think both, probably.
He was a member of the teachers' union.
I guess he was for a while.
I mean, that would have set him apart from some of the people that were using the university club, I imagine.
Gosh, I don't know. I never thought of it.
I don't know.
I remember Walter Morton said the university club was a great place to read the magazines. He thought he got a lot out of it by not subscribing to magazines. He'd read them there.
But you didn't go to the dances. They were very important to some people, going
That's
to the
true.
Dances.
That's true. We did go to some of the dances. Yes, we did. But not as much as some people.
Did he work at night here?
At home? Some.
Did that...
Not
did
a
that,
great deal. He tried
did it bother
to.
You? Or did you
no.
feel that he... that you didn't have access to him about things to do
oh,
with
no.
the house? And
no, not really, no. It's hard to think back to those days. Seems that we were always busy doing something. And there was a lot of back and forth entertaining, you know. It wasn't on a grand scale, but it seemed as though we were always having people for supper or going to their house for supper.
When you look back on that now, did you enjoy doing it?
Oh, yes. Sure, it was a lot of fun.
And you didn't mind getting dinners for a lot of people?
Oh, no.
Because, you know, that's one of the complaints now, is that the women are working and they don't have dinner parties.
Well, that I could see that that would very well, could very well happen. I couldn't do it now, but that's because I'm older. It isn't because I'm working. Because you just, when you're young, you can just keep going. Just keep doing things. And when the kids come along, you just keep moving all the time, either on foot or in the car, transporting.
Yeah.
So then there were nearly 10 years when we had just David, and then 1945, 1943, late 42, Llewellyn got a job with the State Department.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went to Washington again, and that's where our daughter was born, in Columbia Hospital there in spring of 43.
Mm-hmm. And you still hadn't gone back to work. You were still doing college
mm-hmm.
work. Is that right? When did you get your degree finally?
That summer of 45.
Huh.
That was 2 years later from 42.
Yeah.
43. Yeah. So we were there during that war period in Washington. And things were very hectic because it was gas rationing time. We lived in a funny suburb called Cheverly, which had no shopping facilities, so we had to save our gas coupons to go shopping.
Hmm.
We tried to make one trip in a week, and if we had to go to dinner someplace the other side of Washington, that would take any gas that was left, which did happen. And things seemed very grim during that period, and of course Llewellyn would take the public transportation home, and buses were very crowded. Everything was crowded, and shortages were bad. And I got to the hospital just before Heidi was born, and the nurse at the desk said, "Sorry, there aren't any beds." And she went back to her knitting, whatever she was doing there, and I thought, well, gosh, I wonder if we're going to have the baby right out here on this bench. Pretty soon they came and said they had a bed in the hall and ready for me, and so went back there.
Huh.
And I had a doctor who was Dr. Harris's friend and was a very old man about to retire. And he did not like it at all that they had put me into a ward, which was all that they had as a bed. This was quite a revelation to me. Things just weren't like this in Madison. He was very much the aristocrat. Wouldn't step into the ward room the next morning after the baby had been born. He stood at the doorway and asked me how I was. And they had brought my food on a tray with dishes that matched, and my partners in the other beds were all looking because their dishes were chipped. And this was an odd time, believe me. But we had great conversations. It was fun to have more women in the room. The next morning, they moved me to a very lovely two-bed room, elegantly known as semi-private, you know,
mm-hmm.
painted beautiful pink. And the doctor came in that morning and said, "This is a lot better, isn't it?" This was Washington in the Warriors. And Llewellyn was doing work in an office where I couldn't go to see him. I had to wait downstairs. And
did you do any work yourself or join
in Washington?
Anything? Yeah.
Not there, no. But the League is enterprising, the League of Women Voters, because right after we'd moved into the house, a young woman called up. Turned out she lived right behind us. And somebody in Madison had written to her and said that there was a League of Women Voters member that had just moved to Washington.
Oh.
She should get in touch with me. But
so
I just
didn't
have time to participate in League.
You were busy.
Well,
with
yeah.
The children.
Dave was in school, and things were just too rugged. I couldn't worry about joining an organization.
You know, I'm going to have to go quite soon. So I will, and I'd like to ask you, just specifically, did you join the League? I mean, were you still a member of the League when you got back in 1945?
I was a member of the League straight through until I got active politically, and that was after Dan Hone got busy in the state and organized his liberal leagues, which was in support of Roosevelt, and this was in the 40s.
So
and
you, I was going
willy-nilly, I got active politically. It seemed as though maybe single-handed I might be able to stop the war or something, and then I could get on with other things.
Huh.
If we could just get busy and get things in order. And it seemed to me that supporting Roosevelt was the way to do this, and it seemed to some other people that way too, and so I got very, very active. Huh. And at that point, there was a nominating committee of the League of Women Voters, Madison League, and I've been very, very active. Ruth Warmington and I went around and organized the first neighborhood groups in the League of Women Voters when they started that system, and we had lots of fun doing it. We had a Hillington group, which was a good live group. At any rate, the nominating committee called and asked me whether I would be president of the league the following year. And at the very same time, the Dane County Citizens Committee asked me to be chairman of it.
Yeah.
And these two things were impossible to do at the same time because the Dane County Citizens Committee, while it was nonpartisan or multipartisan, was very, very political. And you could not be an officer in the league and be that political.
No.
And so I had to make a decision. And like Robert Frost's poem, I took this road and had to give up the other road. And then after that, I did not remain a member of the league because I just had to avoid having material come in that I was so terribly interested in because I couldn't be active, that active. I'm just one person and couldn't be active in two things.
I wanted to ask you, I know Frances Hurst was involved in the league then, and there was a big split, apparently, in the league. And
now this I'm
So you don't know about it.
No, there always was.
I think it was a Maple Bluff group dropping out.
Well, problems came up while I was on Carol Regan's board of the league, which were indicative of that, except that I thought it was just a natural consequence of the league being a balanced organization because the board was balanced, and we would have 50-50 votes that were very difficult to resolve because half the board was Republican and half the board was Democratic. And questions would come up that were supposedly nonpartisan questions, but people would look at them from one end of the scale or the other. And it was difficult to resolve problems. But they got resolved, and I would have thought with a good president you could resolve them somehow along the lines of the league that you would be able to do it. I didn't really know about the split as such, where people would resign. Go off man.
I'll get more information about it from her, but I just thought you might have another.
No, the League is a great organization. I'm sure that that is how I got educated and interested in politics, was through the League. Mrs. Ogg's great achievement in the League, I think she had been state president, and she almost single-handedly got a bill through the legislature, which I don't think was ever implemented, but it enables two counties to combine if they want to, which is in the interest of economics. So then they would have only one courthouse and it would be more economical. It was an enabling act, and I'll bet it's still on the books, but I don't think any two counties have ever combined. But this, you see, was a nonpartisan kind of thing that the league could work for. Mrs. Ogg was very proud of having achieved this in the league. So, gosh, you could talk about the league all day, the League of Women Voters all day. Talk about the University League, which we haven't talked about at all.
Well, we'll have to continue this. I guess I'll turn it off now. This is the second session of the interview with Gretchen van Kooken, and the date is the 14th of April, 1983. Maybe some of what we'll be saying will be a little repeat of last time, maybe not. I'd like to ask you, you said, when I asked you if Llewellyn ever helped with the housework, you said, oh, let's not talk about that. But that's precisely what would be of interest, I think, to somebody later on, is how husbands, I know most of them didn't, but the fact is, at what, did you ever mind? Did he do other things around the house? Was there a point when he did begin helping? Could you talk about that?
It's hard to get into the... I know that this is a part of the whole women's lib thing now and much talked about and all, but it just... I don't think it's ever seemed that important to me. I just haven't
Well, that's fair enough. But
sure, I minded.
That's important to say.
Sure, I minded. But what you do, you know, you don't change a person, and you don't marry a person because they wash the dishes or something. Mm-hmm. Although he did wash the dishes once in a great while, still does. It's difficult to know what to say to that.
You say sure.
He just never had been used to doing work like that, and I just I don't know how to answer it.
Did when you say sure you minded, you mean it would
occur
to you?
Well, anybody minds when they deep in work and see somebody around that doesn't even see it. Let's say.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a different way of looking at things, and you have to get used to it, I think.
But at some point, most women have started saying, well, why don't you help? I'm working too, or something like that.
Yeah, I know now. But you see, I've never really been a career woman. I mean, I think I came through that period, which was really a transition period.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure if I hadn't married at that point, when I was only 20, I might have become a career woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I was still in the process of trying to get just a BA in school, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And so that alone was about all I could do. It wasn't the same as holding down an 8-hour-a-day job or a 5-hour-a-day job or something like that.
So from your point of view, the difference was that since you were only working part-time all through this period, you always felt, I have more time than he does, therefore I'll...
I don't think I even thought about it. I just don't think I thought about it at all. I did think it was important our son help with things. I know I used to get him to set the table and wash dishes and pick up his room, the standard things.
Uh-huh.
Not that he always did it. And Llewellyn would do things if I asked him specifically about things.
Well,
there were occasions when I might go away for a day or two and he would stay home with David, and I suppose he did the necessaries. I'd leave lists of things and hope that he did them, that sort of thing. But I must say I just never really thought about it much.
Was he always working on weekends and evenings?
He did a lot of work at home, sure. There was lots of, you know, endless reading and sometimes blue books to grade and this sort of thing. Yeah.
Did you feel you had to keep the children quiet?
Well, there was just David for 10 years, and then Heidi came along. No, I can't remember that was a problem.
Mm-hmm.
This is so far in the past, I just can't get my mind on that aspect of things back there. It's very difficult.
But nowadays, do you share the work, the cooking, or...?
Yeah, he gets up and he gets his own breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And
did he used to do that?
He gets his own lunch because he's cut down on his lunch requirements, and he has a standard lunch of banana and toast and milk or the equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
No, because he came home for lunch very seldom, you know. I think back in the other interview.
But I mean, you used to get his breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Did you?
I'd get up in the morning and get breakfast. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
trying to...
Well, you know, I after all, had gone through this. But there was a point where finally I didn't get breakfast for anybody anymore. Mm-hmm. Except sometimes on Sundays, and even then...
Well, sometimes it's hard to get them together, you know, too.
Mm.
Because they all get up different times, and you just get to the point where it's easier just to let them get their own breakfast. That's true. I think.
Well, when you say, sure you minded, but there was nothing you could do about it, you never really felt bitter about it, or?
Oh, I don't think so. Not in that way. I suppose if I'd been a career woman and had a job, I know nowadays people even make contracts about who's going to do what and all this kind of thing. But that just never came to that point. And I suppose because I wasn't the breadwinner, nice old-fashioned word, probably just didn't occur to me that that wasn't what I ought to be doing.
Did you feel less important than, I don't know if this is the way to word it or whether you can understand that, but did you feel that of the two of you that he was doing the important things and that you were helping him out and making it easier for him?
No, I don't think I ever thought of it that way. Can't say that I did.
So you didn't mind that? There wasn't anything, any kind of...
I don't think so, although I think in the university community in those days, a faculty wife was considered to be, you know, the distaff side of the combination, and at least of the older women that were here when we came here, and that I talked about some, like Mrs. Ogg particularly, and Jane Goss and some of the others. I do think they considered it their special part to do entertaining and to entertain certain guests at certain times and mm-hmm. and provide the proper kind of food. Proper is not a good word, but well, the only one I can think of right there.
Yes.
And do things properly and keep up with the give and take of the social life. I think that is true, and that was pretty much a big job, really.
Yes.
When you look at the way, the scale in which they did things.
But what about you? What did you concur in that, and did you, what?
Well, I would have to say that the first time that we were at the Oggs for a big dinner, and Mrs. Ogg would have 12 people 1 week, say, and then at the same time invite 12 people for the next week, and one time this did get into a little difficulty because she had two names that were on a different list from the one she thought they were. So this was more important to her than it would have been in our more informal life, because you had places set for 12, and if 14 mm-hmm. came, this would discombobulate things
yes.
a little. Well, this is minor, and I know she handled it very well, but I was a little floored at the scale on which things were done, and then I soon learned that this wasn't necessary, that the younger members of the faculty had neither the means nor the place to do it on that scale, and so we evolved our own more informal social life.
Mm-hmm.
And I never felt constrained to try to keep up mm-hmm. at all. I don't think it was expected. And that's another thing. I think Mrs. Ogg, as wife of the chairman of the department, felt a special obligation
mm-hmm.
to really do things properly socially.
Did you, when you say we younger members evolved our own way of doing things, did this come in a spirit of, well, I'm not going to try to do anything like that, or was it just, I can't do anything like that, so I'm just going to...
I don't think we thought about it. We just... our lives just seem very, very full, and then aside from the university community, we have quite a few relatives around. We have relatives in Milwaukee and Minneapolis, and sometimes weekends, sometimes whole week of vacation time would be spent going off to Minneapolis, and
mm-hmm.
packing up the baby in the car, and just generally doing that. I know one time when we were still in the little place on Mendota Court that I told you about, Well, Llewellyn was more impatient in those days than he is now. If he listens to this tape, he might be amused.
He won't.
He might be amused. He was all ready to go, and I think he was sitting in the car, and I didn't have the dishes finished up. And so I just plain left him sitting there in the sink, a whole sink full of dishes. And it happened that the landlady, who was a very inquisitive landlady, had been in the apartment while we were gone.
Uh-huh.
And she made it a point to remark to me a couple of weeks later what a good housekeeper she thought I was. This was her way, I think, of getting to me on the dishes that she'd seen stacked up.
like, she was being sarcastic.
I think so. I don't know. I'll never know. But at any rate...
did you leave him because he was impatient?
Well, yeah. If I had had a little more time, I would have done them. But the important thing was to get in the car and go because everything else was ready. And you see, now I think a couple would just... I should have said, come on, help me get these dishes done first.
Mm-hmm.
But it never occurred to me. I just thought, oh, well, it's time to go, and so we'll leave the dishes. Never yes, even I thought about it. Just left them.
Yeah.
And as, what's the difference? No, there they were when we got back, which wasn't nice, but it was easy to do them then.
Mm-hmm.
That's just an instance.
Yeah. Did you have many department parties? Here?
Oh, I mean, sure.
Did you have dinner parties?
Oh, sure. And, of course, the faculty, the senior members of the staff, as I was saying, up until the wartime, up until the 40s, those first 10 years that we were here, say,
mm-hmm.
32 to 40 or 42, the department parties would still be in the homes
mm-hmm.
very frequently, about once a month or so.
And did you give your share of those?
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Yeah. Not while we were in the apartment. Maybe this didn't happen with us until Llewellyn was past the stage of instructor.
Uh-huh.
You see, he was an instructor when we came here and then went on as assistant professor and the usual associate professor.
Later on, as the department began to expand, did it... was it a major source of your friendships? And when you had dinner parties, did you mostly have department people?
No, I think it was mixed. The solely department parties would be mainly the regular ones with the graduate students, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. Otherwise, it would be mixing in department members with other people. And then when I was active in University League, we got to know more people and crossed department lines. And
so these were friends of yours then that you would have?
Yeah, and then Llewellyn belonged to groups on campus that crossed party lines. One group was something called the AFC, which is still existing.
What's that?
That was begun by... Leonard Salter, who was here in the Department of Agricultural Economics.
Uh-huh.
And he and his wife were very tragically burned in the LaSalle Hotel fire uh-huh. in Chicago. But Leonard was a mainspring getting discussions going and things stirred up, discussions going over across party lines,
department lines.
Yeah. And so this group was started, and it was strictly a faculty group.
Men.
But, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess about once a year they invited the wives to the spring.
So it was like a dining club, was it?
Yeah, I was like that. Mm-hmm.
Did they?
And you get to know people in this way, and so become special friends with mm-hmm. certain people. And then two very special friends that were here in the early days were here as graduate student, and then were on the faculty. Or Lee Green was on the faculty. Dorothy, his wife, was and is a violinist. They moved down to Knoxville, Tennessee, but they were probably some of our closest friends when we were here. And we'd go on picnics with them. And,
mm-hmm.
and we're just especially close and did lots of informal things together. We both lived down near campus, and so we could run in the evening just to visit, just be social.
Yeah.
Nothing planned or nothing.
Yeah, that's a nice
especially,
period of time, isn't it?
special, nothing specially planned about it.
Has there been a big change in the political science department as far as the social cohesiveness of the department goes?
I don't know. You see, when Llewellyn retired in 1972, we pretty much lost contact with the younger members coming into the department.
But it was already beginning to expand in the early 60s.
I think so, because with the wartime, I think when we came back from Washington after 1943, things had changed, really, because I think, for one thing, people felt during the war that they didn't have the resources or didn't want to spend the time on social things as much as they had before. Yeah, I think there definitely was a break. Uh-huh. After that period of just not being as social.
But it doesn't...
That wouldn't cover close friends. I mean, you still had your close friends that were...
In the department. Did you have close friends? Who would you call your close friends in the department?
Well, you mean now?
And in the 60s, yes, and now.
Well, starting back, of course, I keep harking back to the Oggs and the Gosses, and then the Kirks were here at the same time. I wouldn't say that we were especially close friends of theirs, but I would say Llewellyn and Grayson Kirk and Walter Sharp were very close friends in the department.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, Bill and Sally Young, who had been here as graduate, he had been here as a graduate student, mm-hmm. then stayed on and is still here, mm-hmm. about to retire, have been close friends across the years. And
anyone else?
I'm trying to be chronological about this in my
mind. Well, you don't have to be.
No, I know that I'm trying to think of it in that way, and I know that I have some complete blind spot here because Ruth and Bill Ebenstein, who left here quite a while back, were very close friends, and that would have been in the years the late 30s,
uh-huh.
40, and in there. And Bill, too, had been a graduate student here, came here from Austria, and became very, very famous in his field. And let me think. We were very close friends with Frank and Helen Hanna, who were in economics.
Mm-hmm.
And then good friends of Mr. and Mrs. Witte, who were also economics. And Ed Witte touched on, is this a name familiar to you?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay. Touched on political science, too, of course. There was a period when he was in both departments. And I believe he was chairman of... political science briefly back there. There was a complete break in the way things were done when Mr. Ogg retired as chairman of the department, because I believe President Dykstra was president of the university then, and he put into effect a rule that I believe had already been on the books, that there should be a department election for chairman each year.
Uh-huh.
And this, I believe, was the first department election that had been held in many, many years.
Yes, it's.
And so from then on, the chairmanship was passed along from one person to another.
Mm-hmm.
And so there wasn't quite the same feeling about the chairmanship, and probably not about the wife of the chairman from then on. Things just became different.
Yes.
They evolved. I don't know.
The department grew very rapidly in the early 60s. I think in 1 year they took on, I've forgotten how many new people, and they were doing that regularly, as every mm-hmm. department was. Do you remember that period and and how the, and of course the whole anti-war movement was developing, and that there was the sort of break between the liberals and the conservatives.
Yeah, I remember the period, not particularly from the department's point of view. That's
well, I was thinking of
something
the department.
You should get Llewellyn to do.
I did, you know, ask him once for an interview, and he didn't
I
want
know.
To do it.
I wish you could get him to do it.
Well, maybe he'll change his mind.
I know he took his stint as chairman of the department and didn't have any particularly high ambitions to be an administrator. Well, we were harking back to the friends. Good friends of Bill and Rosamond Rice. And then, of course, Bill taught international law in the law school, and Llewellyn taught it in letters and science. But they both discovered that this was approaching it from a different point of view. I know Llewellyn took on his Bill's class once when he was away for a period, and said that it was difficult to teach in the law school, teach international law in the law school, because it was a different approach.
Mm.
But we were friends socially, partly because Llewellyn had mutual friends in the East and had known about Rosamond Rice when we came here.
You mentioned that last time.
There are always these outside things that influence you without you realizing it. You think?
Well, Leon Epstein was...
Yeah.
Was
Leon and Shirley. And so many of these people came here as graduate students and then stayed on as members of the department.
Did you take care of the financial affairs in the house? I mean, did you do the income tax? And
no, that's always been a division of labor. I've paid the bills, taking care of the checkbook. And Llewellyn does the income tax. And which, up until this year, it doesn't seem to have been so complicated. But this year, when the forms were supposed to have been simplified, they seem to have gotten more complex for some reason or other.
Did he do any gardening or house repair?
No, gardening is not in his province. He has been known to mow the lawn in his younger days.
But you did it mostly, or the children?
Well, I love gardening. I didn't mind that. Yeah, Dave was stuck with the lawn.
And who did the garbage and fed the pets? And,
I must say, Dave got saddled with quite a few of those chores.
Yeah.
And the pets were... Llewellyn was real good about walking the dogs that we've had. And liked them. Real good friends. But he was not the person that would see the garbage bag lying there and put it in the garbage can.
Oh.
I just honestly don't think he sees things like that. It's a gift.
Well, it certainly is. Sometimes it's one, sometimes it's the other. So, somebody always has to see them. So
that's true.
I've heard of households where the...
And then my father lived with us for 10 years. And when he was here, he did an awful lot of dishes.
Oh.
And he was great at picking up and things. He would... I remember his bending over one time saying, "Nobody ever picks anything up around here." I don't know what it was that he'd picked off the floor. A thread or a stray piece of paper or something. He was brought up in Germany where people were taught to be very neat. So actually, I did have really good help while he was here. And he was then between 77 and 87, and all that time he was very vigorous up until the last few months.
Wonderful.
So that he did a great deal. He was kind of a built-in babysitter when Heidi came along, too. So the last summer in 1945, when I went back to school and took Helmut Rader's wonderful course in Romantic German literature, I probably would have done it, but I'd have had to get a sitter. And because he was here, I could just go off to class and leave the baby with him, and things were fine. So actually there are these things you don't think about, you know. You've been lucky, but didn't really think about it at the time.
How long, you said that you helped him to some extent. How long did you go on doing typing? How long did you go on doing that? Did you? I don't know whether he was very prolific in writing, so maybe it wasn't an issue.
He didn't write a great, he wrote some articles and book reviews. And didn't write another book after the textbook. He and Professor Hartshorn worked on a book. They taught a course together, combination of political science and geography, and had a book on the verge of being printed, but it never quite came to birth.
Did that bother you that he didn't write another book?
Why should it?
Well, it does some wives.
I just, his career was his business, and I just didn't think of it in that way.
You didn't
feel it should either bother me or not bother me. No. If I thought about it, or as I think about it now, his forte was teaching. He loved teaching. And I loved the students, you know, and this kind of thing. And there's always the publish or perish theme that runs through all of professional university life, but I don't think it'll ever be resolved.
I think the reason you say why should it, that for some wives it becomes an issue because husbands are keep talking about it and they keep saying they're going to do it and they want the time to work on it. So wives feel very guilty if they take time, and therefore they feel if they're going to be so respectful of their husband's times, at least their husband should produce a book with all the time they're making for them. Do you see what I mean?
Well, I see what you mean, but it never would have occurred to me. I was just too busy with things I was doing myself to worry about something like that.
But in other words, he didn't impose any of his own guilt on you then about it, because I think
so.
That's what's often happening.
I don't think so.
Or maybe he didn't feel it.
One of the things that had been on his mind after the San Francisco conference in 40, that same summer of 1945, fateful summer of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, when he came back from the conference, he went around the state giving lectures about the UN. And in fact, I just visited Mary Farrell in the hospital yesterday, who is now 86, I think, and was recalling that she had been the person in the extension division that had booked him when he went around on his lecture tours. And I was telling him about it when I got home, and he said, yes, she was a hard taskmaster.
Somebody said I should interview her.
Oh, she'd be wonderful. She's a wonderful person. So after that, he, of course, incorporated the UN more, and I think more than he had before, the concept into his teaching, and he had in mind for a number of years to conduct a UN seminar.
I think, if you don't mind, I'll just